Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Sunday, March 28th, 2004. Today's session is entitled Justice, the Fifth Practice for the Lutheran Outdoor Ministry Association Retreat. Session number LOMA 2004-05. Let's listen in.
Did it take 40 years for the people of Israel to get from Egypt to the Promised Land when it's about 200 miles? Now, there are some answers to this are that Moses was a man and never would ask for directions. The other is that Moses was an INFP. And those are the people that never want to bring anything to completion. And then there's another reason that's serious. Okay. 40 years in the wilderness. And to think of it this way, that if they would have gone right to the Promised Land, which with animals I figured out would have taken maybe 2 months to get there, that they would have gone into the Promised Land with an Egypt mind. They would have gone into the Promised Land knowing only one way of a society to live together, and that is the way they had experienced in Egypt, where some come up on top and they have the riches and the wealth and the power, and then there are those lower and those lower, and then there are the most exploited ones. I think there's an old saying, it was easier for Moses to get the people out of Egypt than to get Egypt out of the people. And I remember a similar when we visited Namibia during the apartheid years and was standing in front of the church with a Namibian pastor, and a group of people went by, walking by on their way shopping. And I remember the pastor just saying spontaneously to me, he says, it'll be much easier to get South Africa out of Namibia than to get South Africa out of the minds and the hearts of these people. So what did God do through Moses but set up a 40-year outdoor ministry? I like that. Have you ever noticed how seldom any teaching goes on in the entire scripture that's inside? That you are the norm, and it's the people that crowd into darkened buildings that are the odd ones with the Bible. But now, I like to call it the wilderness school, where now these people will go to outdoor classrooms, and then now they will be taught another way that a people live together. And that is then in their teaching, where they, in the wilderness school, where they learn about new ways to live together when it comes to debt and slavery and land distribution and especially food. Manna in the wilderness is a response to a teachable moment when everybody's crabby and complaining about food, and then the announcement that the manna is coming. And the way the manna is given and the way the people are taught to distribute it, there in the wilderness, they learn the way of mishpat. I like to say that instead of justice, because in America, justice usually means criminals getting their due. But the Hebrew word mishpat, which comes from, I think, the creation story when God made everything and said it is very good. And so deep in the heart of God and the passion of God is the desire that every living thing and every human being has dignity, has safety, has food, has a belonging, and is treated fairly, as the way to live says it. Justice is to be treated fairly. And so they learn, and then there's covenant making too, there's worship too, that enforces and reinforces. But just briefly, two examples. We know many of them, but the teaching about gleaning, that we'll never cut up the crops to the wall. There will be food for the sojourners and food for the widows and the orphans. And the vision is that when they become landed people, they will live the wilderness mind and not the Egypt mind. So there's a teaching about land and debt in the teaching about Sabbath, about the Sabbath year where all debts are canceled, and also the year of Jubilee, when if someone has lost the land entrusted to them, then at the Jubilee it will go back to the original steward family of that land. So this is the wilderness school. Will they remember this when they enter the land? Now, why does God teach justice through Moses and the other teachers in the wilderness? And it is this dream that there be a society on this earth where there is not the rich power group up here it's getting richer and richer and richer, and then there are the exploited people down below who are treated unjustly to finally not having enough food to eat, and then the basis then is for revolution. And there is another way. Now, what's fun about the New Testament, especially in the book of Acts, the first Christian community reestablished the wilderness teaching in the way they lived together. Now, I want to bring this home to a church camp, that treating fairly and treating one another fairly would have to do with everything from our tax systems to the way young people treat each other in school. You are now in the state of Washington that, along with Alabama and maybe one other state, has the most unjust taxation system in the United States, where the poor bear the greatest burden, and the working poor, and the even the middle classes. Then all the way to school, and the wonderful example of the boys in the cafeteria that kept a notes rating girls 1 through 10. And each one of them had a scorecard, and the girls found out about this. And this also is justice, because the desire of God's justice is for dignity for every person, and this is robbing those young women of justice and dignity. Now, before, and just one other thought, that one thing from the prophets in the Old Testament and Jesus, that how does God judge a society? And I think an answer is it's how that society treats the ones who are most vulnerable. That is how God would judge a society. And again, it's out of the beating heart and compassion of God. So here's my hope, that eventually in the church, that justice will no longer be the concern of the five liberals who are on the social ministry committee. You know, that it will just be thought of to be in love with God, and to be loved by God is to follow the heart of God. One of the things that's just fascinating to me, and stories is one way, but what happened in Alabama during the last election, where this woman, Susan Pace, wrote a scholarly article on biblical justice, and then showed how Alabama was totally out of sync with the Judeo-Christian understanding of justice in the Old Testament. And the governor, newly elected, a conservative Republican, read this, and because he was a Christian, he said yes. And so you had the amendment in Alabama at the last election to change the tax code so the largest burden would not be on the poorest. It was defeated by a landslide. And especially it was a Christian coalition and the business interests that fought it. But here is a conservative person that says, the Bible. I got it. So is that possible in America? Is that possible in outdoor ministry? To see this is not a side issue, but it's the heart of a loving God. Do you want to respond anyway? Or?
That's pretty good.
I did better once.
What happened to that governor?
He's still governor there, and he still believes.
Took a hit.
Yeah. But the
Because his own people turned on him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was the poorest people that, by the largest margin, voted against it because of the television spot advertising, and also the Christian Coalition, according to this article, the Christian Coalition very intentionally chose to smear the woman who wrote the article that came out in the Alabama newspaper. Yeah, so between those two.
What magazine is that?
Soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this has been in Christian Century and Christianity Today, too. It's been quite publicized in church circles. I know. It's amazing about it, it's not a screaming liberal, but it's a vibe person that got it.
Yeah. It's amazing how strong that the Christian Coalition is. I'm just always astounded that treasurer of our synod a few years ago ran for state treasurer in Idaho. And she was very conservative Republican and was expected to win. When she was interviewed by the Christian Coalition, she didn't answer some things the way they wanted, especially on abortion, and she was smeared and defeated so soundly, and she was a top runner going into it. What strikes me in a lot of issues, but as I work with and talk to young people, how difficult it is in the high school world, middle school world, to be a Christian. I talk to kids who talk about that it's the real right-wing fundamentalist kids who are, you know, out there, who everything is black and white for, and where do the kids that are fit in the middle? Because then the kids of non-believers sneer at the Christian kids, so they're really stuck in the middle. And I think about how do kids in a separation of church and state world, in a peer world with such distorted views of Christianity, connect their faith and make decisions based on their faith? And how do we, as outdoor ministries, how do we help kids re-enter the world where faith can, or a camp can be a spiritual refuge as well as a place to gain tools to help them the rest of the year? Just throw that out as a question. How do we do that?
Could you rephrase the question?
One young person said to me, how do I find my way between the hyper-Christians and the non-believers at school? And I guess the question is, how do we help kids to gain tools in our camping program, where most of them are there for a week, maybe two, to go back to be bold about their faith in the world? I don't know if you've seen that, Janet, that article yet?
No, I haven't.
I should have brought it again. Maggie Wells, who lived here for 5 years, there's an article in the Spokesman Review, and she organized a group of kids to start a whole recycling program at their high school. And it's just fascinating to read that about as her way of trying to live out her faith. But it's really in a separation of church and state, she's not talking about her faith, she's living out her faith. But are there tools that we give to kids? I mean, you've all heard young kids say, well, You know, I have to go back to camp to get refueled by not getting that anywhere else. How do we get them to be bold about their faith? And I think it's harder against, you know, with the fundamentalists, the black and white, the...
You know, the way that's worked for me has been, for 13 summers anyway, is the Key West Sermon Week program, which for between 80 or 100 and 300 kids that came down over a 6 or 7 week period, they are immersed in a microcosm of the United States where there's very wealthy, there's a lot of politics, a large gay community, tourists, because the cruise boats come in the summertime at about 8 a.m. in the morning. There can be 2,700 people walking around there. And what's been very helpful, I think, and dangerous, it's been a dangerous operation in the summertime because of all that. And what's really been good is that that little 2x4 island in the Keys has a large number of agencies. That, because when people think of Key West, they think of spring break, which is happening right now. A lot of stuff going on, you know what I mean? Spring breakers. They think of vacation, they think of yachts, and they think of party, and, you know. Jimmy Buffett, exactly. Because you can go to the Buffett place to have a hamburger, cheeseburger in paradise. You know. I've been there. Good hamburger. $7.95. You get a lot. So it's, a, you know, it's an expensive place to go. What? Margaritas. I mean, it's cigars. I got the cigars. I got all these young people. So you know, it's there, and it's a week of that, and as part of it is the servant stuff, where they get to work in a nursing home, they get to work on people's homes that are shacks, because those are the folks that came over from the islands way back when the Kennedys were there. You know, it was the whole history. And so we do the history. We paint the shack that's sitting next to a $5 million place, you know. And we have people from the community talk to the campers while they're there. And we do the work and we do the reflection, action, reflection model. Now, the dangerous part of that, so that's worked really, really, and so you see the tug on the justice, you know, the very rich, the very poor, and the folk, that this lady doesn't keep her house up because if she fixes it up, her taxes are going up. Hmm. So we get into the whole politics. You see. And then as part of it, we do snorkeling, we do some neat stuff, sail and sunset sail and a snorkel, and that, you know, draws people into the environment. And then we go to the Metro Community Church. And for that hour, kids can sit and ask any question they want, you know, about background of gay, lesbian people. And that really gets things turned up. And then we have to follow up with that in terms of conversation. And some groups choose not to be part of that. And then that brings up the whole idea of community. Well, why are those folks with their pastor going over there and having an ice cream cone, and we're over here at Metro Community Church? So it's a real, it can be a volatile situation. And in 13 summers, I've only had maybe 2 letters that went to the bishop, copied to me, carved to the bishop, saying, what the heck are you doing with our kids? Exposing them to this crap, you know. But it hasn't been bad. There's only been one group from Georgia that came down, and they didn't want any part of that kind of stuff. So it's a real churner, and that's how it's worked for us. What's good is then the groups go back home, and then they say simple things like, well, why haven't we gone to a nursing home, or why haven't we gone to this agency, or why haven't we got connected that way? Mm-hmm. What's that all about in our community? And some of the leaders that go back, they'll pick up on that in their community back in Minnesota or Wisconsin or North Carolina or whatever, your son.
Do you do any follow-up with the leaders after they've left to see if that, what they picked up there has been spread out?
No, we haven't done any program where we send them information. We do the voucher information at the end. But I get plenty of feedback. Where in our camping ministry, where lives do get changed. You know, people come out of their shell and they didn't want to go on the trip, and now they're doing something back at home. But not a formal follow-up. That's been a powerful program and experience, and it can happen other places. You know, North Carolina does it in the Appalachians. Or is it Appalachians? Appalachian State University.
Could I add something, or a question to that? I have this memory when I was in high school, I went up to the migrant camps in the San Joaquin Valley to help with the Vacation Bible School. And the reason I went was there were five girls from Modesto that were coming down to be part of the program. So a friend of mine and I went. And, you know, it was all this fun with migrant children, having them crawl on your lap and playing games with them and having all kinds of fun. But the third night, the grape farmer, who was also the missionary, took it into his living room and sat us down. And he says, "Now I'm going to tell you why these people are poor." And he just laid out the whole economics of the thing in a way, and we were at a teachable moment. And, you know, and it's something I never forgot. And I compare this now. Our youth group at our church goes down to Mexico every year to help build a house. And then they come back and then they report on Sunday morning their experience. And almost every one of them reports, "I'm really glad I went down there because now I can be so much more thankful for what we have here." In other words, they've had no help to put it together. And that's why I'm amazed at your program, I think. How can we do that more and more?
Outdoor ministries, John, over the years, very intentional because of that kind of history. I've worked really hard to create servant events that are action, reflection, and not patting ourselves on the back and look what we've done and how much we have to be thankful for, but understand the injustices. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us have been a part of those.
The other good avenue that we have for all of us to latch onto, and Keith can talk more about it, is Lutheran Disaster Relief Network, where we spent in Atlanta, you know, last month, a time with two of the LDR people, one out of not the Bahamas, out of
Mississippi
and
Puerto Rico, no,
and the islands,
St. Thomas,
yeah. Where we think of those places as, oh, I just want to go in there and screw around, but they really still need lots of help. And there are camps, especially up north, New York, and nowhere else, they'll take groups down there in the wintertime. And even with Haiti going bananas, there's a group that left from Florida last week to go out to Haiti to do some work. So there's that opportunity, even though it's in our backyards. Mm-hmm. But at least we're not getting to it in our backyards, down the mountain, you know. Yeah. We can go to those places and then come back and hope that some changes can happen.
I think one of the best things we do is a lot of the kids who come to our places is for them to experience a place where there's some justice for them. You know, a lot of them that come aren't going to the sports camps because they were the last ones picked from the day they were in first grade. And they come to camp and hopefully their experience is one where they really get accepted for who they are and valued for who they are. And a lot of our justice ministry is done in those cabin groups. Mm-hmm. And if you can send a kid home with the sense that they are worth something, mm-hmm. and gradually come to recognize Christ in every other person, if you can help kids do that, you're a long ways along the road to helping transform society.
So it's justice, not so much politics, but it's just simple human dignity, isn't it?
Being treated fairly.
Fairly.
Equally. Mm-hmm. Valued.
Just another part of that here is the roles that children and youth play in decision making. And I don't know to what extent that's possible in the camps, but I think one step from self-value is power. I can influence things. And I remember one little girl here who was 9 or 10, and she was editor of the month in the elementary school newspaper, and she wrote a column about why there should be pets in Holden. Yeah, which happens to be one of our several controversies here. And she took every possible argument about that people say because of the wildlife, because of the taking care, because of allergies, etc. And she answered every single one of them. And then she said, therefore, there should be pets at Holden. And so that was taken into community meeting. And led to community conversation, led to 3 meetings worth of discussion that she participated in which she discovered that the community was equally divided on that issue. And we didn't change the policy, but she was able to see that her voice was taken seriously. And I think different ways that we try to include youth in the decision making, it helps them to get a sense that they actually can influence things. Because earlier in the sessions we talked about the feeling of helplessness and how that is so debilitating among young people.
Did you?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what I was thinking. I was thinking about my cat while you were talking. It's something that I was thinking along Wayne's line too about. I think children and youth love rituals and value ways of formally honoring things. And I was kind of tying the justice theme together with the fact that, you know, camp truly is, as Wayne said, one of those few places in the world where it doesn't matter what your net worth is, you share the same cold showers with everyone else and the same meal and the same, you know, so you kind of live in a way that honors the theme of justice. And I have been thinking about ways to form that into a ritual that goes with kids. We all have rituals and closure to the week, and I remember things where counselors would think hard about Bible verses and give each one their special verse because that person reminded them of the theme of the verse. But it would not be hard to lift up the fact that we've tried to experiment here this week with justice, with just living. Mm-hmm. And obviously we need the help of God in that, and obviously we fail. Our community does not look very just as we look around this room and all of that. But at the same time, there might be some ways for me to go back and think about of ritualizing experiences that help kids remember that life was meant to be good for all. And mishpat is a word that can be added to the vocabulary of a child.
Mm-hmm.
If you lay that word on a child in some way, they will remember that the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do that because we've mm-hmm. captured this community in a special way. So that's what I'm going to think about going back and being more intentional about that. We do that to a degree now, but mm-hmm. there can clearly be some ways that I can do that more intentionally.
I just think of the garbology duty here, you know, that everybody deals with the garbage instead of just the lower
mm-hmm.
class of people.
Mm-hmm.
And what that models mm-hmm. in terms of.
And a dish crew that you probably implement in some ways at your camp. The fact that some people do not get to skip worship. Whose camps closed down during morning worship? Wasn't it Bob Quam again? That
mm-hmm.
everybody.
Yep.
It's not an option.
And for staff and
yeah.
cooks.
And the office is closed. You don't answer the phone. You don't.
Dishwasher stuff.
Yeah. You're not done with the dishes, but you still go and something. That can be declared good about that.
Yeah. It's when John Schramm came as director in 78, one of the first new ideas was that the teaching staff would no longer be called faculty. And number two, they would all be in the dish team rotation. And there was a rebellion.
Was unjust.
Yeah.
It was unjust.
Some did not come
it's
back.
It's big there.
Yeah.
Number three was
but
the pets.
If I could build on that, Dan, because the point that I came is the expectation that everybody teaches. But one of our summer teaching staff recruiters recruited a rabbi, a highly respected rabbi, to come and teach. In Bible study, and she was so concerned that he would be offended to be asked to do the dishes that she said, don't put him on dish team, I'll take his slot. So it did not take very long the first week for Rabbi Marks to discover that everybody else was doing dishes except him. And he was outraged that he would have been treated exceptionally. And said, I don't know, what is he, 70 something? He said, yeah, I belong in the dish pit with everybody else. And so it's come around full circle to be excluded would be an exclusion from community.
Yeah, he knew mishpat. I remember being on Pots and Pans next to a real big theologian from England. The whole time with his hands in, says, I'm never coming here again. This is our
shut up.
I didn't hear that.
He said, shut up and do the dishes.
Shut up and adjust. Yeah.
Outdoor ministries, when you think of our cabin group, our small group, we all know this, but sometimes I think we take it for granted. And when I got away from outdoor ministries, I even thought about it more, that where else, there is no place else in the church where you can have a week of kids living together, black, white, rich, poor, differently abled, living in community together. I mean, that doesn't even happen here. They live with their families, and they are forced to live together. And I remember being a counselor and kids coming up in Cadillacs with drivers. This was in Ohio. I was a camp counselor. And another inner city kid with a paper bag, and I had to find a blanket for, and someone else coming in a wheelchair. And I remember at the end of the week forgetting which one came in the Cadillac. I didn't know. And it was just amazing because they built, it was justice that just happen with these 10-year-old kids.
Remember the name of the Cadillac?
When you said that, Diane, I have to read this, and this again is from, was done at the board meeting for Holden from by Mary Emily Wells, but she said, "I believe that a full life is a life lived in community, and that in community the pastor washes the dishes, the teachers chop the compost, the mechanic leads vespers, and the head bus driver grills the salmon for dinner. In community, a child can speak up in staff meetings and be heard. In community, it matters what you buy and how you throw it away. In community, no one is left kneeling at the cross alone."
Left what? Left
kneeling. At the cross, kneeling alone.
Oh, yeah. Reminds me of hearing a priest in Central America telling us how Guatemala, this rural church where a very outstanding theologian was going to preach on Sunday, and he got there early, and there was Juan Campesino was there early too, and he just started asking him about all of his political opinions about the country and everything, and instead of answering the the man just started crying. You know, the priest thought he'd said something wrong and then asked him, and he says, "No, this is the first time in my life anyone has asked me my opinion about politics." And so, and it just that reinforces that to me. What does it mean that every child coming has dignity? Which leads me to a question. When I went to church camp as a kid, everything was built around competition between the cabins, including athletic prowess and beating each other, and then the winners that were honored at the end, and then...
used to have best cabin awards.
Yeah, best. Yeah. And I assume that's absolutely changed.
Yeah. Other than the gold plunger award for keeping your cabin clean.
Mm-hmm. Which is, but like a hand, back then, differently abled wouldn't have had a chance to be contributing.
We've had a last couple of years been partnering with Lutheran Social Services on a Kids at Risk camp program where we bring some of the troubled teens they work with and mainstream them in camp. So they're not singled out as, you know, we don't have a week where it's all troubled kids. But they're just part of regular groups, and the reports of some of those kids, you know, that this is the first time in their memory when they've been treated like just being another kid.
I don't know how many of you are at family camps, but I think about why I am concerned about justice today, and I think some of it has to do with that I came here almost every summer as a kid, and I spent a lot of time in this balcony with my head leaning over, listening to forums on really controversial issues and seeing adults interested in justice, and that got me interested in justice. And then I was welcome to be there as a kid. And that was a really powerful experience for me. And I don't know if there's opportunities for families to be in conversation together about issues of justice at camps. But even if there aren't families, I think about the Let Justice Roll gathering that's here every fall, which is, you know, 75 to 100 high school youth that really do have a concern about this stuff, and they gather, and there's a weekend youth retreat for them. But I'm thinking about even summer programs that have justice as a theme and really assume that that's going to be part of what people study and talk about as they gather. I mean, I think these kids really feel treated as young adults and important when there's something with meat in it, so to speak, in terms of helpful conversation around justice issues when you're a high school kid. I don't think it's too young to do that.
And I think there's something too about modeling, being passionate about things and being bold about, you know, speaking about things that are important to you. I was thinking back to your original question was something about how do we resource youth to go back and hold their ground essentially in a fairly aggressive conservative society. I think it's very easy for some of us to be real thoughtful and careful and not get to that passionate kind of just saying what needs to be said sometimes. And then tooling kids to do that. There's a Peace Museum in Chicago, no, a Children's Museum in Chicago has an exhibit on stereotypes and prejudice where they have racist comments and then a variety of possible responses you could give. And then, of course, you can write your own, and then you practice it. They have tapes of the comments, and you practice speaking back into it. So it's, you know, modeling. How do you speak back to this stuff and not just kind of wither away or, you know, fight or flight kind of stuff, but how do you just deal with it assertively? And then on a bigger scale, the community organization I was with in Chicago trains youth to speak to power, to go to City Hall and to articulately address their demands. And, you know, it's, I think there's some of that that needs to be giving kids resources to speak powerfully. And to do it by doing the same thing ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Do any of you, you know, have, when you have community meetings or staff meetings, have kids as part of it? You know, some camps have done that with, you know, representatives from cabin groups or whatever, so they could be a part of speaking in certain aspects. You do that now? I like that about what you talked about at the museum, where there's actually a practice in how to see that.
That inspires me. I mean, how could we do that in the church to practice? And I, even my, you know, if someone tells a joke about gay, lesbian people, you know, we tend to be. And
it's easy to be nice or to want to be nice or to just avoid dealing with it.
I think your original question about talking about this girl in high school and not being a fundamentalist and not being an unbeliever and where they walk is where a lot of our kids are that come to our camps. Yeah. And they don't know what to do with it. They choose to go to Young Life, they choose to go to the Campus Crusade, they choose to go New Age, or they get with the kids that are garbed in black because they don't have any place. And I don't know how many kids I've talked to in that spot, and they feel so lonesome. When they finally go to a church college, one of our church colleges, many of them have told me that's the first time they've ever been in contact with other kids who thought like they did. Even within the church group, at their church, they feel alone. Now that's really lonely. Those are high school kids. Because they don't want to party, they don't want to go out and screw, they don't want to drink their way through high school, they're not a big jock, they're not the best in the drama club. They're just good, solid kids. And they want to walk their walk, but it's many of them have said it's a real lonely walk when you're in high school, especially in small towns, where there isn't a big group available to walk with. I mean, you know. So I think it's a, I don't have an answer. I think it's a very, to be aware of it may be one of the best things as instructors we can do. Be conscious of it. Because I think so many of us come out of, are in our own background, we were kind of leaders in our schools, and we don't understand a lonely kid, and we were never lonely in our lives. I was always on some team doing something, or, you know, I mean, I was lonely, I don't mean that, but the appearance of we were here because we were somehow along the line identified as having some leadership abilities. It's hard to identify those with those who have never had that chance. To be conscious of that, to be sensitive to that, maybe the best we can do. Otherwise, you never hear these stories you talked about, Mark. Because you're not interested in them, you know. Get your act together. Join a group. Quit wimping.
You know, it was the same kind of, it just hit me when I heard this. The same way that Christian, when I talked to a lesbian friend who says, you know, I feel ostracized from the gay and lesbian community because I'm Christian. Mm-hmm. Then they're thinking, why are you that? Those are weird people and da 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 da. And I'm ostracized from the church where I can't even say who I really am.
Yeah.
And then when I heard high school kids say the same thing about high school, I don't fit in with the fundamentalist, black, white, you know, hyper-Christians, they call them. And I don't fit in with the non-believers. How do I walk this walk? And that's, I think, being aware and the tools, or like Ralph said, maybe there are some ritual-type things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, most of you know that Sky Ranch had a peace and justice focus for many, many years under my predecessor. And when I inherited this, there were certainly aspects of that I felt were out of date, and I didn't appreciate the separateness of some of the programs that were out of context of the integrity of the camp. But that wasn't my predecessor. That was often what we do with these things when staff get a hold of things without ongoing guidance and so forth. Not that that's bad. But anyways, I moved there the week of Columbine. And Littleton is an area that is a prominent area that we serve with some of the one of the largest congregation we serve. Is right next to the high school. And so you know, we worked with these kids that were coming out of that and issues. And I'm kind of in response to you. I think there's a tremendous role that we can play in dealing with issues and speaking out on issues in ways that certainly might be controversial, but it takes a lot of depth and maturity and research and understanding. And the following fall, I wrote a grant. I think I got about $16,000 out of Lutheran Brotherhood at the time and wrote a curriculum called NOVA, which is Nonviolent Alternatives. And it has a simple questionnaire that we can use with the kids that identifies areas of violence and specific kind of issues that they need to deal with. And it goes through the victimization and violence against the creation, violence against self, violence against others. It follows one of the Augsburg books, really, as a source book. But anyways, the point is, we took this and the thing is not designed for the kids. It's designed for the staff so that we can teach staff how to deal with some issues. And they all have their own issues that they want to deal with and some strong feelings depending on, you know, where they might go to school or what community they come out of. And it was really interesting. It's certainly a challenge, but over the years there have been, you know, in the open sessions where, you know, you often have counselors design electives and kids pick and choose. A lot of those were electives related to social issues. And depending on the age, you know, one of the greatest social issues that we discovered was bullies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like, who knows about bullies? So we start doing some research, and the Canadians have an incredible thing within the education system about how to deal with this power issue in the schools. And you know, so that starts coming out and has an impact on the cabins. Yeah, you will have to deal with that in our own camp community from time to time. But anyways, we still use this program, and I think we have tried to be, it's part of our mission to deal with peace and justice, and I've tried to be honest in dealing with that myself as best I could. But there is that role that I think all of us have played from time to time to deal specifically with issues, whether it be gun control, whether it be gay and lesbian friends and family, and in a way that somehow helps kids communicate feelings and learn and pick up resources and go home with a better understanding. And, you know, like Bob said, it's risky. The letters come pouring in from time to time, and you know, what does Mom say when you say, "My counselor was a lesbian," you know, and found that out in my workshop, you know. So, what? There you go. It's a messy world, isn't it?
I think sometimes before you can run, you got to walk. And for Bear Creek Camp, like maybe a lot of camp, very inward, introspective kind of place. Some people looking out from pastoral standpoints have said it almost seems cultish. You know, everybody's working on themselves. I was real pleased though with the our struggles with a new philosophy statement for our programs that. In one quadrant of the statement that dealt with the individual, while a lot of conversation was on affirmation and salvation, people pushed that conversation into challenge and sanctification. And so we had ended up with a mirrored statement of our philosophy statement that, yes, we want to be affirming place. Yes, we want to hold up that you are forgiven and you're in a gracious community, but I was real pleased that our philosophy statement said that then immediately we need to challenge and we need to push our kids out there that you, there's, yes, you're affirmed, but you're not finished. Yes, we love you, but we want you to affect the world. That was a small step for Bear Creek Camp, but it's exciting already. Some of the seeds that were planted back in Chicago when we had the conference there, somebody had suggested taking some of your staff training into the inner city, and finally that vision has caught on. This year our staff installation is not going to happen in the white towers of Bear Creek Camp, the bishop's coming to us, but we're going to be taking it down to Fishtown and having a staff installation at an inner city church. And then all afternoon is going to be interaction with an inner city congregation and listening to some of their stories and understanding the kids that are coming, that have gone through injustice and are coming from impoverished congregations and situations and abuse, and not just letting them come to our little conclave and hoping that they go home feeling good about themselves. But so it's and that kind of ties back in with the whole welcoming aspect that we first started with. They're going to bless us in so many more ways than we bless them. But so. Our second step then is now challenge the staff so that they can come back and now challenge and kind of shake loose some of the kids into some areas of justice. I'm looking forward to the theme for this summer, Life is Good, because it first saw that I thought, it sounds like, we're just going to praise God that, you know, we've got all these great gifts, but I think it's, we can take that then and go into areas of justice so nicely. Life is good, but you know, how can we help it to be good? Also, for people that maybe have a little tougher time saying that.
You know, Margie, the other important one that you just reminded me of as you were talking is our day camp programs, big time day camp programs, you know, in Ohio, where we go into the cities and get immersed with staff that work with the kids that are there, not bringing them to our nice places.
I guess just a different thought that I have is that justice education or practice, it's partially programs, but it's the learning of it is is available in constant interaction. You know, as the kids observe how staff are disciplined, for example, with what honesty that's handled. I mean, there's so many opportunities in which, to me, it starts with awareness and speaking truth to power. And I will share probably one of my, right up there with my, one of my most humiliating experiences here, by way of a teachable moment for everybody, which was that one night after dinner, we had done a Las Posadas celebration and we were going to pinata. And the kids were getting pretty eager for the time of this pinata, and the adults were still sitting around the table. And the kids were kind of behind me, and I came over to Roseanne Martinez, who some of you met earlier today, and I said, Roseanne, I think it's time for the pinata. The natives are getting restless. Mm-hmm. And she turned to me and she said, I can't believe you said that. You know, of course, all these kids are watching this exchange, etc. And it was one of those light bulb phrase I've used all my life, unconsciously, you know, where she spoke truth to me in a situation where these children observed what was going on between the two of us in care and community. And, you know, it was one of those simple, powerful things where everybody around that table learned something. And, you know, and, you know, God bless Roseanne for right calling it the way it was right then, you know. And I think all the way around, the opportunities, it's about developing inner consciousness about all of these subtle ways in which we practice racism, economic injustice. I mean, it is also about programs to broaden awareness, but we got opportunities to practice all the time. And I don't say that anymore.
About the practice of justice, right? Reminds me of that Seinfeld. Remember that one episode where he kept blubbering when he was dating a Native American woman, and he kept, did you see that?
Yeah, the cigar store.
What?
The cigar store, Indian.
Oh, everything. And I mean, it was just a great episode on the things that we don't think of consciously. He kept trying, I'm not racist. And he'd say something to us.
Honest Indian, I'm not racist.
I wonder, it's so interesting that in that survey that we just did, you know, diversity was way, way, way up on the list in terms of importance. And yet also the struggle of how our staff communities can truly be diverse. I admit failure. I mean, I'm so saddened about my inability to create a more diverse community with the dialogues that we've had, the relationships we've developed in all sorts of areas and on reservations. I look at brochures in our church from camps across the country and so forth. And I just, we need a special blessing for this.
Yeah. I just picked up a brochure at one of our camps, and there was not one photo in it of anyone other than Caucasian. And that just, how does someone read that if they're picking it up? Amazing.
But maybe that's what their camp is. I mean, they can't invent.
Diane, who is closing our session today?
You are.
Jeff. Okay. Any other comments before Jeff closes in prayer and we do a closing hymn?
One is that Keith and I would be willing to talk to any of you about, we had a Region 9 meeting, and it was multicultural, and we were invited to that, camps were invited to it, and that was in December, and last month we pulled together one that dealt with, for the region, and chose people that dealt with the same subject, and had campus ministry and other folks that came to that two-day meeting. And out of that, it was focused on what could we do in our camp and in our campus ministry situations to be more in tune with that. So we have to talk to you about some of the things that came out of it.
I could say something else on that. A few years ago, we heard Raleigh Martinson speak about how any agency of the church or part of the church that deals with youth could maybe come together. And I know, Eli, I think you, where'd you go? He's gone. Oh, there he is. Shadow. You had done that in Minnesota, and I'd always thought it's a good idea, but we never really had a focal point. And now I kind of feel we have a focal point. And I think in my own life, this is an area that I've really become convicted of. I wish I almost could have had a practice of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. And so I'd certainly be glad to do that. And I think I mentioned at another session, what I've done in my case is found a couple African-American coaches mm-hmm. where I can really... They'll hopefully be honest with me, and I can share how I'm feeling. And it's a very slow beginning, but at least it's a start. And
well, the whole private grant program really hopes some of that bringing together diverse groups dealing with different populations, like the camps and the campus ministries and the schools in the area, I think could tackle some of those economic, social justice. Kinds of things, you know, that's really going to be high on the list of those who are granted.
One of the things that I spent some time with in the last few years was that AARP organization. One of the things that I learned from them in terms of organizational management and restructuring and reinventing themselves and getting new brands and all that stuff, I never ever went to a meeting that was white only, ever. And if there were not people that were part of the group, AARP found them and flew them in to Rapid City, South Dakota. And, I mean, it just was not permitted.
Wow.
And that is an amazing thing that happens in terms of group process. When you never sit in a white group. And so I found that very, very impressive. And I have no idea why the Lutheran Church could not do the same thing. I mean, that's just like, it's so simple. And they found people who cared, and many of these people were volunteers. They were not paid staff. And of course, the staff was always multicultural, but they had volunteers, and that was their role. That was their assignment.
I mean, to speak for them.
To yeah, they volunteered to help this organization in that way, and it was pretty remarkable.
Do you want to set this up formally to have a time to? Okay. Okay, thank you all for sharing.
I think one of the things that, you know, if we're going to be committed to justice, we have to be held accountable. Roseanne held you accountable. You're building friendships with African-American pastors who will, in their best mind, hold you accountable for what it is that you're trying to do. And that's important. It's important to be held accountable. Because our backpack that we carry is not what others carry. And we need somebody to hold us accountable. And we all have excuses for why our camps aren't doers. We don't have the time. We don't know how to do it. We never find staff for who are diverse to work at our camps. And we can find every excuse to stop that from happening. But we've got to think differently. We're on the frontier of leadership in looking at a world that is rapidly changing. And we have great opportunity for that. I don't have the answers either. I struggle with it. But it wasn't until hiring Reggie that we looked at how we go about getting our staff. And if we just keep doing the same thing over and over again, we're not going to change. We're not going to bring in diversity. When we were in Chicago, Reggie got the buttons. It's not an option. Justice is not an option. In the 2-3 years Reggie has been there, he's been very deliberate in changing the way we go about recruiting staff. And it's paying off. So I would encourage anybody that would like to talk with him about how you may go about doing that to give him a call. I mean, we're trying options at Lutherdale, and we're failing, and we're learning. But it's a start, and it's a process. We don't know it all. And one of my favorite authors that dealing with issues of racism, Flannery O'Connor, and I've taken this kind of out of context from her conversation, but she said, I suppose it's like a marriage, that when you get into it, you find out it's the beginning and not the end of the struggle to make love work. And if doing justice is that, it is the beginning of the struggle to make love work. Can you join me in prayer? You asked for my hands that you might use them for your purpose. I gave them for a moment, then withdrew them, for the work was hard. You asked for my mouth to speak out against injustice, and I gave you a whisper that I might not be accused. You asked for my eyes to see the pain of poverty, and I closed them, for I did not want to see. You asked for my life that you might work through me. I gave a small part that I might not get too involved. Lord, forgive my calculated efforts to serve you only when it's convenient for me to do so, only in those places where it is safe to do so, and only with those who make it easy to do so. Lord, forgive me, renew me, send me out as a usable instrument that I might take seriously the meaning of your cross. Amen.
We'll sing on page 241. Thank you.
we are.